Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Nall. This is the Progressive Commentary Hour. Today, you're going to hear from two uniquely different people. People who believe in defending freedom of speech, believe that you have a right to live your life in your own authentic way without being shamed and ridiculed and mocked and erased, simply eliminated from all contexts of decency. In effect, you become a pariah. For what reason? Well, maybe you're a person that believes in complementary alternative medicine. Hence, Wikipedia destroys your reputation with impunity. And you have no recourse. None. What if you come up with some interesting findings? Findings that show, for example, that the coronavirus is not as deadly to the mass of people, but is particularly deadly to those with comorbidities. And therefore, there should be a different protocol for those who are obese, have heart disease, cancer, emphysema, dementia, or in critical care to safeguard their health. And the rest of the population should be able to go on about their normal lives. If you're a physician or a scientist or epidemiologist suggesting that, which there are many, you have no forum. You're erased. You're no longer on Facebook or Google. So you simply don't exist. You're persona non grata. Now, historically, we could like or not like what someone had to say, but they had an opportunity to say it. Today, that's not the case. And we're going to look at this from a deeper perspective. First, we're going to hear from a person you probably have not heard from. She's an outstanding journalist who for a long time worked at The Guardian. Her name is Melanie Phillips, and she'll be talking in four separate short interviews. They're all with the same person. But in these short interviews, she talks about what is the difference, the real difference between the so-called liberal today versus the historical liberal, and the conservative today versus the historical conservative. What do they have in common, and what do they have that is polarizing? It's an extremely interesting set of discussions. She is brilliant. And because of her speaking up, she herself was attacked by her own colleagues at The Guardian. Interesting discussion. But this will be one of those lights going on in your consciousness. And then last week we had on Brendan O'Neill, a firebrand, an extraordinarily exciting person to listen to because he is so interesting, and so much of what he said is just spot on. So he's going to give us the benefit of learning about a spoiled, out of touch with reality culture of tens of millions who simply don't have the maturity or understanding or political awareness or social consciousness or spiritual ethics to realize you're out there doing something foolish. You're demanding attention to yourself, laws and rules. Do you understand the consequences? So if you like last week's program on Progressive Commentary Hour with the whole hour's Brendan O'Neill, you'll certainly like this last 12-minute segment. Now to our program.
I said to my colleagues one day in the editorial room, why do we seem to have a double standard? And there was a terrible silence. And I realized at that moment that I'd crossed a line. I had no idea what the line was or why I'd crossed it, but I realized I'd stopped being one of them and I'd become one of you.
Of London, Melanie Phillips, welcome to the Rubin Report.
Thanks, Dave. Very good to be with you.
I'm glad to have you, because I mentioned to you right before we started here that for about 2 years, I've been getting emails and tweets and Facebook messages and all sorts of things, people saying you got to talk to this Melanie Phillips. Now, you're in Jerusalem now, but you also split time in London. For my American audience that may not know you, can you just do a little Melanie Phillips 101, a little bio before we get into the specifics of your work, your writing, your speaking, your books, that sort of thing?
Sure. Sure. Well, I am a British Jew, born and bred in London, of parents who were themselves born and bred in London. Had a fairly conventional upbringing of the type that British Jews in the 1950s had. Parents not very religious, not very observant, but nevertheless belonged to an Orthodox synagogue. I went to Oxford University and read English literature, which fits you for everything and nothing, and fell into journalism. Yeah. I was trained, though in those days journalists were actually trained, and we were taught things like objectivity and the need to be truthful and the need to be factual and the need to separate fact from opinion. Would you believe such a thing? And I spent 2 years learning all these trade crafts on a local newspaper. In Britain, we have national newspapers. We don't have syndicated columns like you do. But I was on a local newspaper in the suburbs of London, and then went to a magazine and then went to The Guardian. The Guardian is a bit like the New York Times, but more so. It is the kind of journalistic crucible of left-wing thinking in Britain. And at the time that I went there, I didn't ever really consider myself to be left-wing, but because I wasn't very ideological. I considered myself to be a liberal. Now, I know that the word liberal means something different in America from Britain, but what I meant by that, what I mean by that, was that I thought of myself as an old-fashioned liberal. That is to say, somebody who believes in making a better world by making people by prioritizing the good that people do over the bad, standing up for the vulnerable against abuses of power, standing up for truth rather than lies. And at that time, I thought that my colleagues at The Guardian and in the left, that we were all on the same side. And we can talk about this in detail, but nevertheless, over the next few years, I realised that this was a big mistake, and that while I still believed in all those things, they were on the other side. They were the people who actually were the oppressors of the poor and vulnerable. They were themselves racist and anti-Semitic. And during this period, which took 10, 20 years, I changed also in the sense that I became more aware of my Jewish background, my Jewish identity. It became more important to me. And I became very, very aware of the enormity of the big lies being told about Israel. Would you believe I'd never been to Israel and never wanted to go until about the year 2000? The year 2000 was the first time I went, and I didn't particularly like it for various reasons. And then within 2 or 3 years, I had bought a place in Jerusalem because my life and my whole view of the world and my view of myself as a British Jew had completely changed. So that's a very short thumbnail sketch of my descent from being the kind of wise child of the left to being the she-devil of the Western Hemisphere.
Yeah, well, I'm not sure how much you know about my story, but I think a lot of my audience is going, Dave, we've kind of heard this before, because that in many ways, although we're not the same age, we're not from the same country, the story that you just told of coming from the left, from a largely Jewish secular family, I mean, it's very much the same story. And I think in many ways, our politics and the way you laid out what true liberalism is, really, really do line up. So can you talk a little bit, because I get this question constantly now, can you talk about when and why you started to see the split within the left towards socialism, progressivism, whatever you want to call it, versus the liberalism that you just described?
Yes, well, there was one particular punctuation mark which really set me on this path, and it was in 1982. And it was when, in a conversation with my colleagues at The Guardian, I was an editorial writer, and I thought of them as being just like me, liberal in the best sense, committed to truth and reason and decent people. And we had a conversation in which I was very troubled by what at the time seemed to me to be the disproportionate attention being paid to what Israel was doing in its war in Lebanon, which was a controversial war, but it was being portrayed falsely as a war of aggression, whereas I knew, and don't forget I'd never been to Israel and didn't really want to go and wasn't really my thing, but I knew that it was trying to root out the Palestinian Liberation Organization and stop it from attacking Israelis, and the PLO at that time was in southern Lebanon. But it was being represented falsely as a war of aggression, and at the same time, out of the woodwork came unbridled anti-Semitism, that we British Jews are all considered to be basically all sticking together in a clannish kind of way and defending Israel. And I was very troubled by this, and I was very troubled by the fact that The Guardian was spending such a disproportionate amount of its time in hurling terrible obloquy at Israel over all this, whereas at the same time, President Assad, the father of the current President Assad, had caused a massacre of his political opponents. Something in between 15 and 40,000 of his opponents were killed over the course of a couple of weeks. And that story didn't really have much traction at The Guardian. I couldn't understand. I was a different person then, didn't really understand what I was dealing with. And I said to my colleagues one day in the editorial room, why do we seem to have a double standard? And there was a terrible silence. And I realised at that moment that I'd crossed a line. I had no idea what the line was or why I'd crossed it, but I realised I'd stopped being one of them and I'd become one of you. Mm-hmm. And they said, well, of course there's a double standard. After all, they said to me, like you, and I became you, and by you they meant Israel, and I'd never been to Israel, like you, we in the West are brought up to believe in the sanctity of life, respect for human rights, human dignity, whereas people in the developing world are not brought up to believe any of those things. And so if they kill people, we cannot judge them by our standards. That would be racism. And I thought, what? And I said to them, what are you saying? That if one is unfortunate enough to be born and bred into the developing world, then one does not then have the same rights to life and liberty that we do. To my mind, that's racism. And they said, why are you so upset? We do you, and I became you again, the great honour of assuming that you are like us. You have the same moral standards as us. And what's more, you tell us that you, as the Jewish people, are morally superior to us. Now that is A, untrue, and B, it is sheer anti-Semitism. And at that moment, I realised that the assumption I'd made that we were all marching under the same banner of truth and freedom and decency and all those good things, that was untrue. That I was marching under that banner, but they were on the other side. They, the liberals, the left, the people who assumed that because they were the liberals and the left, they embodied virtue, and everybody who was not the liberals and the left was a bad and evil person, they were the racists. They were the anti-Semites, and they believed in lies, and they were irrational. Consequently, the logical flaw in that is that if you can't say that anyone's lifestyle or culture is better than anyone else's, then you can't say that liberalism is better than anyone else's. And consequently, you can't defend the fundamental liberal values of freedom of speech and tolerance of other points of view and freedom of religion and all those things which make a liberal, tolerant society. You can't defend them. You can't defend the equality of women. So when faced with, say, the Islamic world, as a liberal today, you cannot say that the West is better than the Islamic world, even though it is, because surely the enslavement of women must be worse than freedom for women.
First off, what do you think is wrong? And I hate to say this as someone that still considers myself a liberal in that true sense. Do you think there is an inherent flaw in liberalism that has allowed leftism and collectivism to basically decimate it? So that there are very few people at this point in the West, certainly in America, who describe themselves as liberals the way we're talking about it. Most of these, anyone listening to this right now would say, oh, they sound mostly like conservatives. I probably come off a little more on the libertarian side of that. But do you think there is an actual flaw in the good sense of liberalism that allowed this monster in? Perhaps a protection that conservatism has that liberalism doesn't have?
Well, the fundamental flaw in liberalism, in the way that it's been developed, is that, let's put it this way, there are different types of liberalism. There's the liberalism which comes out of, I would say, conservatism, or rather conservatism is a kind of defense of liberalism. And if you look at one of the greatest philosophers of what's called conservatism, Edmund Burke, in the 18th century. Now, he's called a conservative, but what he reacted against was the French Revolutionary Terror. He understood that the French Revolution, which was supposedly all about freeing the individual and introducing the rule of reason divorced from religion, a whole lot of other stuff, but that's broadly what it was about. It led directly to terror. So he reacted against that. And as a result, he was called a conservative, and he's still called a conservative. He's called one of the fathers of conservatism. But from where I'm standing, he was actually defending liberalism. What was he defending? He was defending tolerance and freedom and progress and reason. These are all things which I associate with liberalism. Now, liberalism has a fundamental flaw. It is that it has two fundamental flaws. One is that because it prioritizes the individual, it has been interpreted over time in our current time to mean that you can't then establish any kind of hierarchy of values. You can't say that one set of values is mm-hmm. better than anyone else's, because mm-hmm. that's kind of being nasty to somebody else. And consequently, the logical flaw in that is that if you can't say that anyone's lifestyle or culture is better than anyone else's, then you can't say that liberalism is better than anyone else's. And consequently, you can't defend the fundamental liberal values of freedom of speech and tolerance of other points of view and freedom of religion and all those things which make a liberal, tolerant society. You can't defend them. You can't defend the equality of women. So when faced with, say, the Islamic world, as a liberal today, you cannot say that the West is better than the Islamic world, even though it is, because surely the enslavement of women must be worse than freedom for women and equality for women. So that is one of the essential, I think, contradictions in liberalism. That means that it's sort of going down the plug. Plus the fact that it's become a libertarian ideology. That is to say, it's taken the notion of the dignity of the individual and respect for the individual, which in my view is at the heart of liberalism. In my view, that can only be enshrined by, paradoxically, a body of laws and moral values that are regarded as kind of binding on you. But if you detach the individual from those laws, then you get a kind of free-for-all. And once you have a free-for-all, then it's everyone out for him or herself, and then you have the strong dominating the weak. And then you get to a situation very fast, which is where we've got to, where you don't have a liberal society, you have a tremendously illiberal society. And that's made even worse by the fact that this kind of liberalism, or I would call it libertarianism, mm-hmm. is actually an ideology. Now, what's an ideology? An ideology is where the power of the idea must trounce everything else. You can't ever say the idea is wrong. So if you come along with a load of facts and you say, well, this idea is wrong because here are the facts, here is the evidence that shows it's wrong, well, the ideology says you must be wrong. There can be no challenge to the ideology. And so you have to be stopped, you have to be suppressed, because the ideology of liberalism is that it's bound up with the betterment of humanity, the perfection of the world. So anyone who stands against that isn't just wrong, they're actually evil. And if they're evil, they have to be stopped. And so you have this phenomenon in which we have people who purport to be liberal, who are stamping out free expression on our campuses, preventing people from speaking, which is absolutely the absolute antithesis of true liberal values. And that's the paradox of liberalism. It's become an illiberal ideology.
Melanie, you would absolutely love my book. So I'm going to get your address after and send it to you, because I'm making many of the same arguments. And that connection between between truly being liberal and having something outside of yourself, which I think we're gonna get to in a little bit. But I want to back up for a second, because you said that you grew up in a secular Jewish household that was similar to most of the others in the 50s. Can you sort of describe what does that mean? And one of the questions I get all the time now is, what happened to the Jews? How did the Jews all become lefties when the left has become so rabidly anti-Jewish, anti-Israel, anti-liberal, all of those things? I mean, I think you can probably trace a pretty clean thread on that. But can you first describe what did it mean to grow up in a secular Jewish household? Because I think that confuses some people. And then sort of the road that takes us on.
Yeah. Well, to make people even more confused, it wasn't what I would call, strictly speaking, a secular household. I mean, certainly highly orthodox, observant people might well call it that. But I didn't think of it like that. My parents belonged to an Orthodox synagogue. They went to synagogue three times a year, the 2 days of Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur. We did not observe the Shabbat, in that my parents worked. They were modest people and they had to work, or they felt they had to work. But we were kosher, really kosher at home and out. We had a Friday night meal with candles and kiddush, and I didn't go out, but we had the television on. It was that kind of upbringing. Consequently, the conservatives did not realize what was happening on the cultural front. They didn't realize that education was being redefined from the transmission of a culture down through the generations to teaching your children that your culture was fundamentally illegitimate, racist, and should be obliterated. They didn't realize that was going on. They didn't realize that the freedom to junk your husband, the freedom to have a baby without a father, even without the baby even knowing who his father was, and perhaps you didn't know who the father was, that freedom would come with a terrible cost to the child and to the woman, and also to the man. They didn't figure all that out, and all sorts of other stuff. So they just lost the plot. And then, having vacated the cultural battleground, they then observed that society was changing in that direction. And then they said, oh, we can't do anything to stop this. It's like Canute holding back the tide. We must go with the flow of cultural change.
When you see what is happening across the world right now, and how liberalism has sort of failed, and that what that then probably leads to is sort of some version of right-wing authoritarianism or something like that, if you agree with that premise, what can we do? If you want to save liberalism right now, what can people do?
Well, it's this paradox, again, that to save liberalism, you have to be conservative. And I do believe that the problem that the sort of death throes of liberalism have been caused not just by the what's happened to the left or the progressive circles in the West, but by the fact that the people who are supposed to be defending the West against this onslaught have thrown in the towel a long time ago, largely through ignorance. There are not precise parallels between British conservatives and American Republicans, but nevertheless there are certain, I think, constant characteristics that the conservative wing of politics, if I can put it that way, has forgotten what it is in business to conserve. And especially, I think, since the fall of the Soviet Union, which I think was taking place before the Berlin Wall actually fell. The Soviet Union clearly was, in its death throes for a long time before that. And I think that what happened was that that conservatively minded individuals, certainly conservative politicians, the conservative political class, when the Soviet Union fell, it sort of thought, oh, our fox has been shot. What do we do now? We've won. Here is, the Soviet Union having disintegrated. It's no longer a threat. Everyone's bought into the market. Now, the problem with conservatives is that they tend to think entirely in terms of economics. They don't think in terms of culture. They don't understand what Edmund Burke understood during the French Revolution. It's all about culture. It's all about values. It's all about moral values. They didn't think like that. And they haven't thought like that for years. So they thought, well, what do we do now? Everyone's bought into the market. What are we going to hang our hat on now? And they alighted upon freedom. And I remember this happening at the time, and I thought, oh no, they've had it. This is ridiculous, because the left hung its hat on freedom. So what happened was that while the left venerated and worshipped the shrine of personal, individual freedom, freedom to do exactly what I like, behave as I like, have the values that I like, and no one can tell me that I'm wrong, conservatives said that everything that's good in the world is going to be delivered by the free market. Mm-hmm. And consequently, the conservatives did not realise what was happening on the cultural front. They didn't realise that education was being redefined from the transmission of a culture down through the generations to teaching your children that your culture was fundamentally illegitimate, racist, and should be obliterated. They didn't realise that was going on. They didn't realise that the freedom to junk your husband, the freedom to have a baby without a father, even without the baby even knowing who his father was, and perhaps you didn't know who the father was, that freedom would come with a terrible cost to the child and to the woman, and also to the man. They didn't figure all that out, and all sorts of other stuff. So they just lost the plot. And then, having vacated the cultural battleground, they then observed that society was changing in that direction. And they said, oh, we can't do anything to stop this. It's like Canute holding back the tide. We must go with the flow of cultural change. And so they became part of the problem. And that's why liberalism was allowed to become the kind of monster that it has become, which is illiberalism, or as somebody who was a very distinguished thinker once coined the term, and it's so true, cultural totalitarianism is what we're living through.
My friend Michael Malice, who's a brilliant political thinker, he's more of like a anarchist type, but he says that conservatism is just liberalism at the speed limit, which I think is partly what you're getting to there. Do you sense that something has shifted, though? Because I do sense right now that it's partly because of Trump, maybe 90% because of Trump, although maybe Trump is just a symptom of it, but that conservatives have started to understand the cultural part. I think there is a sense of, if you look online, the things that are fun and funny and the memes and comedy, the left has destroyed all of these things through its totalitarian view. And the things that are actually interesting right now are things that are coming out of more right-leaning circles. Do you credit Trump for breaking through that thing in a way that the conservatives would have never done otherwise?
I think the election of Donald Trump was the outcome of a change that had already taken place. That is to say, there were two shoes that fell, if that's not the right metaphor, in 2016. One was the Brexit vote in Britain, and the other was the election of Donald Trump. And on both occasions, I think what happened, obviously they're very different, different phenomena, different countries, but they were fueled by the same thing, which was that the vast bulk of ordinary people, the millions and millions and millions of, when I say ordinary people, I mean the kind of people who don't have typically a higher university education, and who had spent decades being preached at and being scorned and being vilified and being traduced by the intelligentsia, which dominates completely the universities and the media and the whole cultural apparatus. And more than that, dominated politics, because even so-called conservatives, the Conservative Party in Britain, the Republicans in America, didn't really differ that much in these cultural issues from the left. And they were all basically saying to the people, you don't know what you're talking about. You're just rednecks. You're just stupid. Mm-hmm. You don't even have a university mm-hmm. education. You're bigoted. You don't like immigrants. You're racist. So the things that ordinary people value, which is community, which is the attachment to their country, patriotism, love of their country, and the kind of instinctive understanding that a country and a culture is made up of people who share your own values. They don't have to look like you. They can be different colour faces from you. They can be of different ethnic backgrounds from you. But at some important juncture, they share the most important values of that society and that culture, which means that you're all basically sharing the same cultural experience. You're all attached to the nation. You all understand what it means to you. Now, that understanding, that cultural attachment, was vilified as racist and xenophobic by virtually the entire political class.
But now, Melanie, people often ask me, on those occasions when I get asked to talk at a political rally or whatever it happens to be, what do I think are the greatest challenges confronting us in Australia? I think I probably give three broadly. One is that we no longer understand that you have to have a good debate if you're ever to get good policy. We don't know how to debate. We don't know how to respect one another and treat one another properly to get the best results, negotiate our way forward. Another is I think so many children now go through an education system that doesn't expose them to a range of views and help them to think rather than respond to their feeling. And another is that I think we have a dad crisis. Now, that's a controversial thing to say. But you, in your description of your journey from leftism to sanity, said that you really struggled with the way that the left, which had always been a fierce defender of family, started to abandon that position. And I don't want to sound insensitive to people who are struggling with this issue in good conscience, and we all know none of us are perfect. Nonetheless, we have to, I think, be prepared to talk honestly about what really works.
For sure.
Now, I wanted to read a little of what you actually said. You talked about some serious work done back in the early 90s by two social scientists, Norman Dennis and George Erdos. Now, according to this report, there was incontrovertible evidence that children in fractured family units tended to die earlier, suffer more ill health, do less well at school, were more likely to be unemployed, more prone to criminal behaviour, and to repeat as adults the same cycle of unstable parenting. Now, it created uproar, as you put it, not just because of what it said, but who was saying it. The publisher was the Institute of Economic Affairs, seen as right-wing, but the authors were from the left. And indeed, the social science establishment, as you put it, circled the wagons. One distinguished academic claimed the author's research was old, out of date, selective, and misleading. Well, I'd have to say 30 years on, there's not much support for his position. We now know, more graphically than ever, if we look at it, what happens when family structures go wrong. But you say you rang this expert to ask what the research actually said, but when pressed, he wouldn't answer the question. Instead, he released a stream of invective calling the author's mental faculties into question and asking emotionally, what do these people want? Do they want unhappy parents to stay together? He eventually admitted that the authors were actually correct as far as the research was concerned. But he asked rhetorically, where had that got anyone? Nowhere. Was it possible to turn back the clock? Of course not. And why were they so concerned about the rights of the child? What about the rights of the parent? What has happened that it's acceptable to ignore evidence when it impacts on others, particularly our own children?
Well, what that academic went on to not say, which I found out, was that he was divorced. And he was consumed, it seemed to me, by guilt about what he had done to his children. And what I found at that time was that for a variety of reasons, and we have to sort of think ourselves back to a time which was quite different from today, when, you know, lifestyle choice hadn't really been properly invented. It was being invented. And what was happening was that these people who were responsible for producing apparently, ostensibly, objective research were themselves caught up in these family dramas. They were themselves becoming divorced. They were themselves having children who were becoming divorced. And they couldn't bear the disconnect between the objective reality and their own family situation. So they made the objective reality fit their subjective feelings. They twisted it. And I watched this happen. And I watched academics who were committed to the truth get denied grant funding because they said things which were unsayable about family breakdown. And I found that there was an almost impossible task in elaborating upon these objective facts, this objective evidence, without immediately being accused of being horrible personally to people. I was set upon by people who said, how dare you call into question what I have done because I've done the best for my family. I've tried my best with my children. I would say, I didn't even know you were divorced. I'm not making any aspersions about individuals. Individuals cope the best they can with a variety of difficult circumstances. Many people who are divorced or who have are bringing up children on their own do an absolutely magnificent job. They go to enormous and heroic efforts to protect their children. But nevertheless, it seems to me that these are situations of disadvantage. And isn't it better to try to avoid disadvantaging children wherever possible? In other words, we can't possibly entertain policy making which deliberately exposes children to disadvantage on the basis that it makes their parents happy, because we should surely put our children first. And when one's dealing with public policy, one has to deal with the reality as it affects the vast majority of people. That doesn't mean that you're not sympathetic to individuals going through these hard things. Well, those arguments went nowhere at all. The subjective ruled. My personal feelings trump the objective evidence. And this was part and parcel of something that I only realized after many years, that what was happening was not confined to this very emotional issue of the family, which clearly had emotional ramifications because people were personally bound up with this issue. What was happening was that the very idea of objective evidence was being cast aside because it was too inconvenient when it got in the way what people wanted, how they wanted to live their own lives. And as the years went on, it seemed to me that not only was evidence being cast aside, not only was apparently objective evidence by university researchers becoming subjective and warped and wrong and false, but the very idea of evidence was being overturned. The very idea of rationality and reason were being dismissed. And this was all part and parcel of what only appeared to me to be the case after many years, that on issue after issue after issue, family lifestyle choice, multiculturalism, deep green environmentalism, moral relativism, moral and cultural relativism, and all those isms, they were all ideologies. And the point about an ideology is that the idea is sacrosanct. Nothing can get in the way of the idea. That's the first thing. And the second thing is that all these ideologies were utopian. They were all predicated on a belief basically in the perfection of the world. So multiculturalism would eradicate prejudice from the human heart completely. It would stop war. It would stop conflict. Lifestyle choice would eradicate bigotry and the bigotry over differences in people's lifestyles. So no longer would people look down on people who were divorced or single parents and all that kind of thing. They were all utopian. Deep green environmentalism was about saving the planet from frying and being destroyed completely. So anyone who disagreed with these ideologies, anyone who said, well, actually, the evidence shows this is wrong, factually wrong, that couldn't happen, because the ideology couldn't be gainsaid. And because these ideologies were all to do with the perfection of the world, anyone who spoke against them was not simply wrong, they were evil. And it couldn't be said because it was such an evil thing. And so you found that evidence became politicized. it became called right-wing, ultra-right-wing, and all the rest of those epithets. And it became unsayable. And the people who dared to say it found themselves bullied and ostracized and persecuted and removed from their socials. They lost their friends. They lost their professional advancement. They were threatened with their jobs. Some of them lost their jobs. And so you have a situation we have today. And the reason I wrote that book, The Guardian Angel, was because what had happened to me in my professional life, when I started out, I worked for nearly 20 years for Guardian newspapers, the very heart of this liberal universalist ideological perspective. And what happened to me over that period was as I fell foul of that world very badly. But what happened to me seemed to me to illustrate what had happened to the West, what happened to Britain and to the West. And so through the story of what happened to me issue by issue, I could actually tell a bigger story of what.
Thank you. Thanks for having me. I just want to say a few words about the nanny state. And particularly, I want to talk about what I think is the real problem with the nanny state, which is not simply that it's annoying and illiberal and gets on our wick and stops us from having fun, but that it actually undermines the Enlightenment itself, that it actually represents a reversal of the gains of the Enlightenment and takes us back to a pre-Enlightenment era. Of course, it's completely true that the most immediate impact of the nanny state is to make us angry and to kill our joy, to kill our buzz. You know, the smoking ban is one example, which in Britain is now going even further, and we're now banning smoking in parks, on beaches, on Brighton Beach, where you can walk around naked and pretty much have sex in public if you want. You now can't smoke. So really, there's a comedian in London called Victoria Wood who did this funny skit like 20 years ago about a couple having sex on a train, and British people are so reserved they didn't say anything. But then after they had sex, they lit up a cigarette and someone said, do you know this is not, that you can't smoke in this carriage? That's now actually become true. You can do lots of weird, wacky things in Brighton, which is the capital of decadence in Britain, but you can't smoke a cigarette on the beach. That's really annoying. The attack on drinking, the attack on boozing is also incredibly annoying. Lockouts, limitations to when you can buy a drink, what time you can buy a drink. In Britain, we have a discussion about binge drinking, and the government is always clamping down on binge drinking. You should know that the government defines binge drinking as 4 units of alcohol, which is 2 weak pints of lager. Now, that tells you something about the kind of people who rule Britain now. They think 2 weak pints of lager is a binge. So they've actually redefined drinking as binge drinking. So what most of us consider drinking, they consider binging. Nudging, the nudge state, which in my mind is even worse than the nanny state because it's so cynical and secretive. This idea that the powers that be should nudge us in the right direction, should nudge us towards good health, should nudge us to make the right decisions about how we pay our taxes. Even the way in which men aim at urinals is now become a part of the nudge state, where in urinals across Europe, they now have little flies, pretend flies, so that you will urinate on them and not spill. And this is part of nudge policy, seriously. This is part of the actual nudge policy to nudge us towards good behaviour because we're all such animals. And it completely circumvents public democratic discussion and just assumes there's a right way to behave, and the only role of us lot is to be nudged in that direction. So, it's annoying, it's grating, it's illiberal, it's killjoyish, all those things are absolutely true. But it's not enough to say that. I think there's a far more profound problem, which all of this crap represents a reversal of the Enlightenment itself. The birth of the modern democratic era is being undone by these people, by the nanny state, by the nudging state, by the new bureaucratic authoritarian elites that run the Western world. And if you had to sum up the Enlightenment, I would say the whole message of the Enlightenment was that we have to restrict the government's authority over individuals, over both our bodies and our minds. Both our bodies and our minds should be free from external intervention. That's the Enlightenment, summed up in one sentence. Every single serious document and tract and thesis of the Enlightenment had that message at its heart. And it's not surprising that the Enlightenment comes after the Inquisition, because the Inquisition represents possibly history's most shocking intervention into people's souls, into their minds, into what they thought, into what they believed. Nothing was private. Everything was open to policing and punishment. You could be burnt at the stake for what was in your mind. So after that calamity, that historical calamity, comes a new idea, an enlightenment, that people should be free to think what they want and actually to behave pretty much how they want. So one of the first expressions of this new idea came from Edward Coke, who was this great English jurist who basically brought the Magna Carta into the modern world, one of my heroes. He said, "No man shall be tried upon his secret opinion." This was the post-Inquisition message. No one should be tried or punished for his secret opinion, for what he thinks, what's in his mind. It was a revolutionary idea in the 1600s when he said it. And today, again, when you have Barry Spurr being sacked from the University of Sydney for his secret opinion, for what's in his mind, for what he says to his friends in private, it has become, once again, a revolutionary idea to say that no man should be tried or punished upon his secret opinion. Then later on, you have John Locke, his letter on toleration in 1689, which is basically the founding document of the modern Enlightenment. That whole letter is about, in Locke's words, settling the bounds that lie between the business of government and that of freedom of thought. He basically wanted to stipulate that you have individuals over here and you have the government over here, and they should leave us alone. He said the government should only be concerned with outward things, the structure of society, the collection of taxes, various other things like that, but never with inward things, by which he meant our beliefs, our thoughts, even our bodily integrity. There's a really interesting line in Locke's Letter on Toleration where he says, "If a man is making himself ill, should a doctor have the right to intervene?" And Locke says no, because we have to take individual sovereignty so seriously that people should even be free to make themselves sick. And then we move on to Kant, another one of my heroes, Kant and his essay, What is Enlightenment? If you read What is Enlightenment now, it's hilarious, because it is basically an argument against the nanny state. It's basically Kant arguing in the 1700s against the nanny state. And Kant complains about the fact that he says, "I have a book that thinks for me, a pastor who acts as my conscience, a physician who prescribes my diet." He goes on and on about these nannying people who want to run his life and tell him what to think. And he calls them guardians. And he says, "These guardians treat us as domestic cattle." And he says, "They carefully prevent us from taking a single step without the leading strings to which they have fastened us." Now, if that sounds familiar, that's because it echoes brilliantly the kind of system that we live under today. We may not have pastors who think for us anymore, but we certainly have experts thinking for us, parenting experts telling us how to parent, anti-smoking experts telling us how much we should smoke. The same kind of phenomenon exists, the same guardians exist, they just express themselves in a different way. Kant could have been writing about Australia in 2015. It's really worth rereading his essay. And then these ideas are taken even further by John Stuart Mill, who then sums them up brilliantly when he says, "The individual should be sovereign over himself." And that's his very famous line, "The individual should be sovereign over himself." But there's a little clause in there which sometimes gets left out, which he says, "The individual should be sovereign over himself, over his own body and mind." So what you have here is a real articulation of the idea that both our thoughts, our minds, should be free from external interference, and so should our bodies. So should our own person, the fact that we should be able to do to ourselves what we want. And famously, Mill said that it's only when you harm another person, not when you harm yourself, only when you harm another person that the state should have the right to interfere with you. So that is an extremely potted history of Enlightenment thinking, but the same argument comes through, right through Coke to Locke to Kant to Mill, which is this idea that the individual should be sovereign over himself. And I think what we have today is a complete reversal of that on so many different levels. And for me, the thing that summed this up best is not just the drinking stuff and the smoking stuff and all those irritating rules and regulations, but the comments made by the Nudge Unit in Downing Street. Downing Street now has, inside Downing Street, there is something called a Nudge Unit, which is devoted to changing citizens' behaviour. You know, in the old days, citizens would elect a government and then the government had to do what the citizens wanted it to do. Now, in a complete reversal, the government does what tells citizens what it thinks they should do. And this Nudge Unit says that it wants to be the surrogate willpower of the people of Britain. It wants to be our surrogate willpower. And what that means, it wants to think on our behalf and act on our behalf and carve us into the kind of moral, physical, healthy creatures that it thinks we should be. And that takes even further the phenomenon that Kant was talking about, these guardians who are constantly breathing down our necks, telling us how to think, telling us how to behave. It takes it to another level. And I think... So what we're seeing is not simply the rise of petty, annoying rules and regulations, but the reversal of a whole historical epoch. That this kind of 300, 400-year idea that the individual should be sovereign and that the authority should be restrained from interfering in our lives, that is being undermined by the rise of the nanny state, by the rise of the nudging state, by the rise of these new bureaucracies which seriously, genuinely believe that they have the authority to police what we think, to police what we eat, to hector us about how we behave, to control our social lives and everything else. And what's the solution to that? The solution is not simply to complain about smoking bans and all those things, although we should do that, not simply to complain about the imposition of traffic light systems on food, which is what we now have in Britain. Food products are being introduced where they've got a red light, which means they're bad and unhealthy, and an amber light if they're okay, and then a green light, which is they're good, which basically only goes on kale and cabbage and that kind of thing. And all those things, we have to argue against all those things and expose the patronising, ridiculous nature of them. But we also have to constantly assert the value of freedom and the value of individual sovereignty and the importance of allowing people to determine their destinies for themselves, which was a revolutionary idea in 1689 and 1649 when those guys were around, and it's once again become another revolutionary idea. And I think to that end, we should bear in mind the words of Kant again. Kant said, the Enlightenment, it's not complicated, it's really straightforward, and he has this brilliant line where he says, the Enlightenment requires nothing but freedom. That's all it requires. All you need to do is to be free, behave like a free person, take responsibility for your life, cut the fastening strings, as he calls them, that the guardians have attached to us, refuse to play by their rules, refuse to be told what to think and how to behave. And instead, in Kant's words, you should walk firmly and cultivate your own mind. And I think that's the kind of message we should take forward to today. Shove the nannies and nudges out of our lives, and we should walk firmly and cultivate our own minds.
Thank you all for listening and have a nice day.
Mother, mother, there's too many of you crying. Brother, 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 there's far too many of you dying.